Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spech.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Going fantastic, man.
We got snow, buddy. Lots of snow.
We do, and we're going to get more.
And it's cold. Almost beginning of February.
Yep.
Well, I guess not really. The end of January, beginning of February is when the cold weather usually starts.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been noticing walking the dog the last couple of days, the winds are getting frosty. You get that morning wind in your face as you're walking the dog.
It's funny. It's been so mild lately, and our winters tend to be more and more mild of the last couple decades. So, I don't know, like days like this week when the temperature drops like minus 10, it's like minus 10 is nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
No.
But it's like I'm not acclimated to it. I'm not used to it.
Well, it's not so much the temperature as that breeze right in your face. Brisk, baby.
The wind catches the side of my building that I work in. The wind comes off the lake and runs up the side of the building. And so I'm walking from my car. It's like hardly no wind at all. But as soon as I get beside the building, it's like gale force winds. It's like, where'd that wind come from? And then it's peeling your skin off. Your eyelids are freezing to your skin. And it's like, what's going on?
I park at the far end of the parking lot. Farthest away from... Yeah. I mean, it's not a big parking lot. It's like 10 cars or something. So I'm car 10. Car 1 is closest to the building. And they don't have a lot, like the cars next to my truck don't really have a lot of snow.
Hmm.
And then I walk around the other side of my truck,
yeah,
and it's got like 2 feet of snow sticking out the side. It just protected all those other cars because it was coming straight across, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, man. But yeah, that biting wind just gets you right in the face.
But you know what's good? So what was my major complaint over summer?
Mosquitoes.
No. Come on.
Mosquitoes.
It was my... No, that's normal over every summer. What is my normal complaint?
Oh,
it's the gosh darn cormorants.
Oh.
There's no cormorants currently pooping on my car.
No, because they can't find your car because it's so covered in snow. But if there was no snow, they'd be pooping all over your car. Yeah. What I want to know to all my dog owner friends out there...
Yeah.
Why does my dog have to find the biggest snow hill on our walk? So this is generally the snow people have scooped off their driveway and piled beside the driveway.
And she climbs it?
Why does she need to climb that and poop at eye level?
No, does she?
She does.
Isn't that wild?
I don't know why.
She's presenting it to you.
Highest poop wins?
Yeah. This is all
I think that was a family
this
guy.
This is my display shelf. This is my display.
She will climb.
I present this to the world.
Up these tall side of the driveway snow piles to poop.
That is hilarious.
And I don't, being, she'll be everywhere she wants. But she climbs up these things, finds a spot that she's not sinking.
And then you have to climb up to collect it.
No, I just got to reach over. Maybe she's helping me. I don't have to bend.
I'm saving your back.
But I'm just looking at her like, just boop down here. Why?
The neighbors are looking out going, there she goes again.
There's
pooping on the snowbank.
Pooping on the old top of the snowbank mountain. Yeah, it's like a cherry on top of a white sundae. I don't know if anybody else dogs do that, but I
that is strange.
It's weird. Mind you, she also sometimes, and our old dog would do this as well.
Yeah.
When you're at a dog beach or something, or she's down at the river.
Yeah.
She will walk out into the river, and she'll look like she's sitting. No, she's pooping underwater.
Really?
Yep. It's like pooping in the bidet.
That is so strange.
My last dog did it too.
Wow.
And it's not something I teach them, honest. Maybe they just watch me do it.
Maybe. Daddy does it.
Well, he squats and poops in the water. So. Yeah, I...
That is very peculiar.
All the dogs I own, their bathroom habits leave a lot to be desired.
I don't think I've had dogs that have... I think there's only... I had a beagle once who would be pooping and, like, on two legs, pooping on two legs, but walking at the same time. So it's
really?
Like, it's you're dragging this behind you. What are you doing? Would you just
stop
and let
it's
it come
mine.
Out?
It's not mine.
tripod, up on a tripod, walking in a tripod with poop half hanging out.
Yeah.
It's like, stop moving.
No, I just...
But yeah, I've never had a dog do...
No. And then, of course, she's knocking half the snow down on the people's driveways. So now do I feel like I've got to walk the dog with a shovel?
Exactly.
So I can scoop the snow back up?
Yeah, to clear the driveway for them.
Anyway.
That's so strange.
Yeah. That's what my life has been reduced to. A mountain climbing pooping dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Weird. Anywho, what's happening now?
What's happening?
The Wing Group. Do you remember the Wing Group?
So I had to look it up. I had to dig into it because I'm like, oh, another conglomerate or a numbered company is buying up this and buying up that. The Wing Group, have you looked into them?
A little bit.
They do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They make a lot of product. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of money.
They bought a lot of small companies.
They have.
Smaller,
so
independent companies.
Just a little background on the Wing Group. They started 40 years ago. This dude started it 40 years ago. They make inflatable watercraft,
mm-hmm.
sponsons, pontoons, rubber bumpers to keep ships away from docks. They make those elite black inflatable things that the SEAL Team 6 uses and yada, yada, yada. So, like, they make military pontoon boats. These guys make a lot of money. They are very diversified. They make stuff for the military. They make stuff for private. It's well, amazing. So they have a lot of money behind them.
There's definitely a lot of money. Portfolio of leading marine and outdoor brands, including Wing Inflatables, Mustang Survival.
Yep.
We talked about them acquiring them a couple years back.
Yeah, 3 years ago, I think they bought them.
Fabtech, Henshaw, Patton. And they've now announced the acquisition of Kokatat.
Yes.
Manufacturer of premium paddle sports apparel and equipment in Arcata, California.
I saw Alan shared that a few days ago.
Yeah, there is a press release that went out.
Yeah.
And that's where I heard about it first, was there. Then, yeah, he's put it out, and Paddle Magazine's put it out.
Yeah.
And now we're putting it out, too.
Mm-hmm. But this is a big purchase. This is pretty significant. So, Kokatat has been privately owned until now.
I've got... My life jackets have been Kokatat. Yep. My dry suit's Kokatat. And to me, I'm thinking... Like, when I heard this, I'm thinking, wow, that's a big purchase.
And what's good is, at first I was like, oh no, another conglomerate buying up all the little people. But no, it's actually, he's a big company, but he's still somewhat private. He's like a bigger conglomerate, but private. And the things that they could do, combining the technologies and tips and techniques and all that, combining Mustang with Kokatat, I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah. The acquisition is rooted in a long-standing relationship and shared values between the organizations. Kokatat's deep history in recreational and professional paddle sports industry, along with the trust it's earned and it's with end users through a legacy of quality, value, innovation, and excellence, makes it a natural fit within the Wing Group portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Brana, CEO of the Wing Group, has been expanding the Wing Group's scale and reach with acquisitions aligned to its values and mission. This acquisition further strengthens the group's whitewater and paddling presence. Kokatat has been firmly embedded in that value vertical since its founding. We value the talent, technical knowledge, and the company's unique bond with the river. Kokatat brings capabilities that few organizations possess, and Arcata remains a critical part of that expertise and legacy. And that's the thing, is they want to take that company and not change what it's doing.
Just,
you know, learn some of the stuff they do and maybe take some of the stuff that the Wing Group does, some of its smaller companies do, and say, hey, you know what, we can integrate your product with this and give it just that something a little bit extra.
They will be able to share patents across platforms.
Yeah. So that's not, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing when you see this.
No, not this. This one here, I think it's a good fit. It's a good purchase.
Coquitat will continue to operate as an independent brand under the Wing Group with global support from Mustang Survival. Coquitat is continuing operations and is well positioned to accelerate with Mustang Survival's broader infrastructure. Critical resources across the Wing Group will be shared across manufacturing, operations, IT, and planning and quality, while maintaining continuity for customers and partners. Mark Lofmiller, CEO of Coquitat, will remain in a leadership position, working in partnership with Mark Brana, current director of U.S. commercial sales at Mustang Survival, representing the Wing Group. Strategic expansion marks a significant milestone for the Wing Group's global growth. Together with Coquitat, they are committed to continuing to serve paddlers with professionals and professionals with trusted gear. So we'll have to see how things... Yeah, I got to think with all their little bits there, like they say with the manufacturing operations, IT and planning and quality, what new things they'll put into the Coquitat lineup.
The sharing of experience, the sharing of product, the patents and copyrights and stuff like that be shared across platforms. I think it's, and with the far reach of Mustang Survival, like this is a worldwide, again, another one of those worldwide companies that sell like all kinds of gear across all platforms for military, private, and so on. It's impressive. Very impressive.
Yeah. So we'll see what the future holds there.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the future holding, Alpaca.
Mm-hmm.
Alpaca's lead designers spent 10 years bringing their pack raft concept to sea kayaks. The result, a 12-pound inflatable kayak that tracks on flat water.
I've wondered about products like this for years because, you know, you see about pack rafts and it's like, well, does it track? Is it like, is it practical?
Well, that's
is
the big
it useful?
Thing, right? Yeah.
And you're not going to, it's never going to be like a hard hulled, like sea kayak or open water kayak. It's,
no.
It's going to be inflatable, but it's going to be interesting for this.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to modern technology and design, the lines between watercraft categories have become increasingly blurred. Stand-up paddleboards can be kayaks, kayaks can be inflatable pack rafts, and now, evidently, pack rafts can also be sea kayaks.
Blurring the lines.
Yeah, because we saw that stand-up paddleboard there, was that 2 years ago, that you can switch into a kayak, because there's a seat that you can put on it
use
the kayak paddle and all that in case you're to help with accessibility and in case you're tired, right?
Yeah.
So yes, now pack rafts can also be sea kayaks. The minds behind the Alpaca brand that have dominated the pack raft category with sturdy, lightweight, inflatable boats for 25 years has now made a sea kayak, an inflatable sea kayak to be more specific. With its latest model, Alpaca's lead designer said they invented something new, or at least designed a watercraft that can take coastal explorers to new places without lugging around a heavy boat to do it. The Aleutian is made with many of the same materials and design principles found in Alpaca's pack rafts, but its elongated shape, baffling, and removable skeg make it the brand's fastest boat on flat water. Now, if you Google the Aleutian, the Alpaca Aleutian, Aleutian, it looks weird.
It does.
It's it almost like there's a pack raft in the middle of it with pointy ends glued on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right?
It's like, oh, that's a weird shape.
It does look kind of weird, but if it's going to work, right? I love this boat because it makes flat water paddling fun, Alpaca design engineer Dustin Partridge said. There's nothing else like it in the pack rafting market. The Aleutian has long been a project of Sherry Tingey, who co-founded Alpaca with her son in 2000. I can't believe they've been around 25 years now.
I know. It's incredible.
It doesn't seem like it should be that long.
Yeah. And she said she's been developing this specific one for 10 years.
Yeah. In its materials and baffling, the Aleutian resembles many of Alpaca's pack raft models, but by creating an elongated bow and stern and then adding baffles to them, Tingey and Partridge created a shape similar to that of hard shell sea kayaks. Combine those elements with the attachable rear fin, and you've got an inflatable kayak that functions well even against the wind, according to Partridge. Hmm. Even against the wind.
Mm-hmm. It is sleek design. The hull design is sleek. You can see it sits low to the water. It's pointy front and back. I can see where it wouldn't be that much of a detriment with wind.
No. There's also an inflatable pad that sits below the tubes, creating an edge that adds additional stability while paddling. Of course, a genuine touring kayak will need room for gear storage, and the Aleutian accommodates that with tons of storage that can be packed into the bow. It also has plenty of attachments, including four-point thigh straps, ankle loops, D-rings, and strap plates. However, it's always a however.
However.
Aleutian users need to make sure they pay attention to the boat's air pressure. This boat is pack a pump required, Partridge says, referring to the handheld pump made by Kalpaka. Because of the additional length of the boat, you need higher pressure to keep the stiffness when you're in choppy water. If you're in a flat water lake, not really big deal, but in a windy environment, I would highly recommend you pump it up to full pressure. It's not a big deal. Just make sure it's at that pressure. It's not like, unless you got a major malfunction, it's not going to be losing air really fast.
No, not really fast, but the zippered pockets where you can stow stuff inside is holding back the air as well, but naturally air is very thin, so it's going to leak out. So you might have to, depending on how long your day is, you might have to stop and pump it up midday right?
There's a lot to like about the Aleutian, but its weight stands out from the other features. A mere pounds. 12 pounds.
That's incredible, eh?
Yeah. I mean, that's just something you just stick in your pack and go for a walk, right?
I know. Does it say how big it is packed?
No. No, I didn't see any of the stats on it except for the price and the weight. If it turns out that the Aleutian can truly maintain a straight course even while paddling, even at this insanely low weight, it will be an enticing option for exploring coastlines that vehicles can't reach. Oru's origami kayaks are now quite popular for the same purpose, and they do everything an inflatable kayak does, except better, according to some reviews of the best inflatable kayaks. But Oru Beach LT Sport still weighs 28 pounds, more than twice that of the Aleutian, and the Advanced Elements Airvolution Recreational weighs 39 pounds. So you think, 28 pounds over 39. Well, how about 12 pounds over 28? If the Aleutian actually cuts through flat water and even choppy coasts with decent tracking, it might merit a subcategory of best inflatable sea kayak or perhaps best lightweight inflatable. They're currently available on the Alpaca website for a whopping $2,150 US.
So that's not too bad, considering it's an inflatable. Like a proper sea kayak or flat water kayak, they're going to be thousands of dollars. So this one isn't that crazy. And for somebody who may have not enough space to store something, if you're a condo owner, if you have an apartment,
loves doing the exploring,
it can go into a closet.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
This would be something you want to be like. This would be great for bike rafting, maybe.
Maybe, because it's got the same sort of center size where, like, you see people do pack rafting with bicycles and stuff.
I'll just clarify there. I'd be thinking more of bike rafting up a coast.
Yes.
So go up the coast and then paddle back.
Yep.
Not necessarily like most of the stuff
because
we see.
Because it's super light. You're not carrying a lot of extra weight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, Alpaca Aleutian, $2,150 US. What's that going to be in Canadian? Like $10,000
after taxes, close to $3,000, I think.
Oh yeah, at least.
I haven't done the math, but there's going to be taxes then duty, the conversion rate, and
well, it's going to come to Canada eventually, right?
Yes,
I think probably the summer they'll start.
So if I was to guess, we're probably going to see it in Canada at some of the local places. We'll probably start seeing it at like say $2,900 or something. I'm guessing. Because you never know. You can't do a direct comparison unless you're going to go across into the States and buy it and bring it back. And you're still going to pay taxes and duties on that transfer. Yeah. But, you know, it's...
But at the end of the day, as much as I'd love to have a pack raft, if it comes down to $3,000, that's going towards a canoe.
Yes, true. Yeah.
That's just me personally. Yeah. I mean, you know, as much as, yeah. Like I say, I'd like to have a pack raft, it's, yeah, that's
but
just...
it'll fit into some people's wheelhouse. It's going to be...
Oh, I think it's going to fit into a lot of people's...
It's going to match a lot of checklists for a few people, right?
This, well, like, even people with big boats.
Yeah.
You know, those big boats you can sleep on sort of deal?
Yeah.
And you go out and you moor off of an island or a chain of islands. You pump this baby up and you go tootling about the islands.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff.
Whether it's a houseboat, a sailboat, or something, you're just
houseboaters, man. They're going to love something like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's so many, and when they talk about going up and down and exploring the coast, that just opens up so many opportunities for this thing.
Yes, absolutely. Right. You're not confining. If you're out on a tour, if you're out doing something, you're not necessarily having some gigantic sea kayak on your roof the whole time, or tied to the roof of the houseboat, or, you know, strapped to the side of your sailboat. It's one of these things. It's like they make a lot of packable items for people who do tripping like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, bicycles that fold into three pieces type thing, so you can fit it into the hold of your boat or fit it into the trunk of your car for people who do extensive tripping like that. This does fit, you know, it's going to tick a lot of boxes for people who don't necessarily want to kind of trundle around in a raft. They want, no, I want something that's that has tracking capability that I can use as a normal, regular kayak. And this meets that grade. I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, because honestly, when you're talking pack rafting, your majority of people are thinking rivers and whitewater, right? And, I mean, as we said, the bike rafting and stuff like that, and then hiking up somewhere and then setting that up and flowing back down the rivers where you started, sort of deal. But this opens up a whole new big water.
Yes.
Places to do this sort of thing. Which is pretty cool. Yeah. So go check it out. The Alpaca website. Snag one.
Alpaca Aleutian.
Mm-hmm.
Aleutian as in the Aleutian Islands.
Yep.
Hmm.
Speaking, let's stick on some new gear. For some reason, it seems people I know this year, over the last year, have taken up bird watching.
As people do.
As people do when they get older. Just going to slow down and check out some birds. We've actually had sightings of a couple owls in our neighborhood.
Yes, I've heard. I've seen some stuff online.
Yeah. So somebody is just around the corner from us taking a couple of pictures and posted them on the north.
There's Bowmanville, somebody saw a snowy owl or something?
Yeah. Oh, every year out in Bowmanville, there's one that comes by.
Yeah.
Hangs out there for the winter. Now, we've had discussions about AI.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, because I do the photography stuff, if you're using AI and trying to pass it off as your photo, you should be shot. Shot, cut into four pieces, buried in four corners of field, dug up, and kicked off the planet. That's just my opinion. There's a couple of other steps that would be included in that I can't say.
Tell me how you're going
to feel. So when it comes to AI, you know, that's I'm a purist when it comes to you should be able to do your photo in the camera.
Yes.
With as minimal post-processing as possible.
If you do, I'm of the same opinion. If you do a lot of post-processing or you use AI to do your work, you can't just say, hey, this is something I did. No, AI did it for you.
Yeah. So I have no problems with people putting it into Photoshop and doing a couple little, you know, sharpen this sort of thing or add a little bit, bring out that color sort of thing. As long as you're not, I've seen other people go to town and Photoshop. I'm like, dude, that is so far from the original photo.
Yeah.
You can't even call it your photo anymore. Right. But that's a me thing. That's, you know, everybody to themselves sort of thing. But so when it comes to AI, we've had the discussions that I think the only thing AI is good for is comedy.
Comedy.
It's making memes. The memes and the little videos. And I'll watch that all day long because I giggle my butt off.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else, I'm kind of like, I'm up in the air about mostly, no, don't need it, doesn't belong, that sort of thing. So when I saw this, I'm like, oh, well, I don't know. The two biggest problems with even the best binoculars is they only provide a solo experience and the images are fleeting. By contrast, Matata Explorer's compact Solvia ED 8x32 AI binoculars allows you to capture and share images. Plus, they have a few AI-based tricks up their sleeve. Now, these aren't the first binoculars to grab videos and stills. Sony's Dev 5 back in 2012 were essentially two high-zoomable camcorders fused together that looked and worked like binoculars, but they were way bigger, at least twice as heavy, four times the price, and great as they were at the time, lacked the external screen and modern identification smarts. At this point, you should be Googling Matata Explorer Solvia, S-O-L-V-I-A, ED 8x32 AI binoculars. They look like those little tiny binoculars you have, but there's buttons on one side at the top, and then there's a little, like, you know, the back of a digital camera screen on the other side. So basically, when you're looking at it, you're putting your fingers on the screen. And of course, I'm sitting here with my hands in front of my face like I'm looking through binoculars because it makes me speak better. These just to be clear, you can still use these just like traditional binoculars. Okie dokie. Individually adjust the right and left diopters to match your vision and gaze right through the eyepieces. Wide dynamic range provides a clear, natural, detailed image in a variety of light conditions, and electronic image stabilization smooths out the inevitable real-world shakiness. So even those old people who can shake in their hands trying to look through binoculars are going to get less shakiness.
Yeah.
To see.
I'm trying to find here, because I had... I probably still have it out of the box somewhere, because it wasn't that practical, but it did work. Back when I had a telescope, I also, I think it was called a Celestia a Celestia tool or something like that. You could point it at the stars and it would identify what you're looking at.
Okay.
Because it would connect to the internet. It could identify stuff. It knew the location of planets and the stars. So, and it had some kind of, it's just like the motion sensors in an eye. Do you know how you can take there's apps on a iPhone or a Samsung or whatever. You can point it at the sky and it says, yo, here, this satellite's crossing here and that's the moon and here, this is Jupiter.
Yep.
Well, this thing is something similar, but it was before smartphones did it. It was in a device, an electronic device. And so this is what these binoculars remind me of, but now it's going to be able to take photos of birds that you're looking at, and you'll be able to identify birds. Hopefully it does better than the audio tool. It says, oh, that's a loon.
Mm-hmm.
That's a loon. And that's a loon. And that's a loon. And that's a loon.
When you want to capture the moments, an 8-megapixel CMOS sensor lets you record full HD photos and video with simple dedicated buttons for each. View your shots on the 2.8-inch touchscreen or on a nearby smartphone through Wi-Fi screen mirroring, which I do that with my GoPros.
Yeah.
Like if I have my GoPro on my forehead, I can look at my cell phone and it links.
Yeah.
So I can see what my phone or my GoPro on my forehead is.
Yeah, make sure you've got it aimed correctly.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And yes, you can one-tap share your favorite logs and or... social platforms. Most recently, digiscoping has become a thing. Let's assume you've moved beyond the clumsy, unreliable nightmare of trying to manually steady your phone to an eyepiece.
I've tried that. It's a pain in the butt.
I actually have a monocular thing, a pretty powerful one. Yep. And it comes with a device that mounts to your phone.
Oh, okay.
And mounts to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just automatically, it holds your phone camera up to where it's supposed to be. And then you just, boink, press your take a picture button.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're focusing and everything with the monocular.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say monocle, but that's like the guy from Monopoly. even with the most efficient purpose-built rigs, you're still stuck hauling a dedicated phone case adapter, standard-sized tripod, and girthy optics. Which is, that. Mm-hmm. which you then need to quickly assemble in the field, so it's clunky at best. The Matata unit is clearly smaller and smarter, allowing you to be much more in the moment. But here's where the real magic kicks in. These binoculars were trained so quickly, trained too quickly, identify over 10,000 common bird species around the world with up to 98% accuracy. So you might not be able to tell a yellow warbler from a Eurasian blue tit, but the Solvia ED sure can. So if you're out there and you're bird watching and you go, oh, look at that. Then you can just like take that picture and then on the screen identify, oh, look at that. It's an eastern yellow wobbler, warbler, whatever. It's a loon that looks like a chicken.
So I'm wondering how they came up with a name for it. Because Matata is, I had to Google
Hakuna
it.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. But Matata on its own is Swahili word for problems or troubles.
So if you're having trouble exploring, this will help you.
And Hakuna Matata means no worries or no problems.
If you want to identify other flora or fauna, just upload a photo. Upload the whole fauna. Get that deer in there and upload that. To the cloud to instantly match it to a database of tens of thousands of plants and animal species.
Yeah, I'll come back as a loon.
All of them are loony. Beyond identification, AI also helps improve image quality, boosting low light scenes and de-blurring images when necessary.
And you know what? I can see bird watchers taking advantage of this.
Yeah. You know what? If they're bird watching, and that's why with this sort of thing, it's not like you're going to be using these for a big photo expedition. Exposition sort of
thing.
You're
just out for a hike and you want to identify some kind of bird.
You're going to put them on your social media, stuff like that. That's cool. I can let that one go.
Yeah.
I'll pick my battles, right? These small all-in-one binoculars weigh 560 grams, or about 1.25 pounds.
That's not too bad.
IP64 dust, water, and fog resistant.
There you go. That's good.
The fog resistant thing, really, until I started taking my camera gear on canoe trips, and then you get up in the morning, and you get your camera out, and the lens fogs up.
Yep.
Really, I really had no problem with fog resistance until then.
You and go
then
from all a cold place, you go into a building or a tent, and everything fogs up. And it does make a difference.
Yeah. There's been some canoe trips where I pull out my camera first thing in the morning, and then it's the first time it's been out since the day before.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, okay, there's that picture I want, and it just slowly spreads, the fog.
Well, you hear about people who do photography and do bird watching and take their digital SLRs, they acclimate their camera. They leave it out in the cold for a bit for it to normalize.
Yep. You have to. They can operate in temperatures ranging from minus 10 degrees Celsius all the way up to 50 degrees Celsius. It's not bad. So we could use them today.
We could.
Just. An onboard electronic compass and GPS positioning let you retrace your adventures. You can adjust a whole host of professional photography parameters, such as white balance, saturation, and exposure compensation. See, that's getting a bit much.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like same as, you know, digital SLR, yep. Exposure compensation.
According to the pricing from Matata Explorer's successful Kickstarter campaign, the Solvia ED 8x32 AI binoculars will eventually retail for $499.
And that's the kicker. It's expensive.
Yeah. But, I mean, for all that it does,
yeah,
you can see that. That seems to be a decent price for that.
Mm-hmm.
An optional $100 expansion module that adds extra battery and dynamic fill light. See, and that's the part you have to remember. All those electronics take battery power.
Yes, exactly.
So you're going to have to take extra batteries. Yeah. now, my SLR, digital SLR, I got the extra hand grip for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the bottom of that, I slide in two batteries into a pack. But I can take that battery pack out, and I slide in another one that takes 8 AA batteries.
Oh, there you go.
So as long as I got AA batteries, I don't need to recharge, mm-hmm. which is cool. But yeah, when you're dealing with stuff like this, you have to remember, at some point you're going to need to recharge this bad boy, right? So yeah, just keep that in mind if you're looking at one. In the meantime, you can still purchase them at the early bird level for roughly $349 before shipping, with delivery of the first unit slated for March, when the company also plans to open up regular pre-orders at its MatataExplore.com site. And Matata Explore is all one word, but there's no E at the beginning of Explore.
So is it up now?
Early bird level, I guess. So you can check them out on their site. You can do a pre-order, but they're not shipping out till March.
I just thought if it's on Kickstarter. Sounds like it's on Kickstarter.
I think it was on Kickstarter. I think the Kickstarter's ended.
It's not finding it.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah, because I was looking at them earlier.
Yeah.
But, no. Like I say, it sounds cool. Especially if you're, to me, something like this would be cool if you're going out hiking and stuff like that. Look at the bird. And then take that picture so you can throw it on. Like, Athena and I go walking through the forest, I take pictures of this, that, and the other thing on my cell phone. I don't bring all my camera gear. And then I can just go on my socials and post. Spent the day in the...
Yeah.
I did that last weekend. Spending the morning in the woods with my furry friend, and then post a whole bunch of things that we saw while we were out there. And that's about the extent of it. It's not going to be a major photo expedition sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm thinking with this thing is like... You know, if you're going out there and you're doing a lot of walking and stuff like that, and you see something like the owl, for instance, that's not something you see all the time. Click the photos and you take them back, upload them to your Facebook or Instagram or whatever. Hey, I was out walking today. Look what I saw. And impress all year.
Mm-hmm. So it is the Kickstarter campaign for it ended on September 20th,
mm-hmm.
but it's saying you can still purchase off as a post.
The early bird.
Kickstarter, right? Yeah. You can still purchase it.
Yeah.
So it is $349 currently on Kickstarter, even though the campaign is closed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
Right?
Huh.
It's kind of cool looking little binoculars, though.
Yeah.
Right? Fit in a nice little pocket on the side or something.
Oh, no, you can't.
What do you mean you can't?
So it's only letting you pledge to follow the campaign now that it's done.
Is that on MatataExplore.com?
So it's called... The reason I couldn't find it initially is because it's not called the Matata. That's the name of it, but it's actually called a Solvia ED 8x32 bird camera thing.
That's what I've been saying.
Yeah.
Solvia ED 8x32 AI binoculars.
I searched for the Matata. It didn't find a Matata.
Oh, no. MatataExplore.com is the website.
Yeah.
That's where you got to go to find this.
Hmm.
Anyway, check it out. Get yourself some new gear for the upcoming season.
Yeah.
Paddle season. Be good. Well, that'd be good too when you're out there and you're canoeing and stuff, and you see far away, you see a moose or you see swans or loons,
yeah, and you want to get a quick snap on the fly, ducks. Assistant, and you'd
yeah.
Like I have tried lining my phone up with my pair of binoculars, and it's awkward and yeah. hard to use and whatever. So this is kind of neat. I wonder if it has zoom capability. It's a neat rig.
Well, it would. They're binoculars.
So binoculars are usually have a set focal unless it has zoom capability. So not all has zoom capability. So like you can,
binocular I've ever used.
Some of them are fixed. Some of them do zoom, like limited zoom, not a big expansive zoom, right? So this one here is mostly digital, I think. So I wonder if it has a physical lens zoom, or is it all digital zoom? You know what I mean?
Mm.
So I don't really rely, I wouldn't trust too much on digital, pure digital zoom.
No, I would.
Because it gets grainy.
Yeah.
But
I see what you're saying
there. Without digging into it, does it actually have a lens capable zoom capability?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, because when you zoom in on your camera, use that.
You're zooming digital.
On your phone, I should say.
Your digital zoom.
Digital zoom. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
There. So, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I got to think it would be digital.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything on it seems to be digital.
Yeah. Because I don't see a zoom button on the device itself.
I think you should buy one and try it out.
No, not at that price.
You notice it's every week me telling you should buy it and try it out.
I know. It's a neat thing.
Now you got to try it. You got to go look into it. We'll keep an eye on it. See what, because it'll eventually, once it comes out, it's going to have all the reviews, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I just thought it's a pretty cool thing to see, especially for all the people I know that are doing bird watching now.
Yeah.
Looking at you, Kevin Callan. He's got himself a nice camera set up to do pictures now. Yeah. Came across something else here, and I sent you a picture earlier.
Yes.
I'm amazed at how the word canoe gets thrown out as a sort of catch-all word for boats, for some boats.
And I can see how maybe the uninitiated or people who don't have, it's like, oh yeah, that's a canoe. It's like, I don't know. Do you really consider that canoe?
Yeah, sometimes you see it, we're going canoeing, and then you see a whole bunch of kayaks, right? No, you're kayaking, you're not canoeing. Yeah.
Depends on what continent you're from as well.
Yeah. So I came across this story. It said the Ghana Navy has intercepted 7 irregular canoes suspected of being used for illegal fuel bunkering activities in the Gulf of Guinea. And I'm thinking, okay, so what, they got maybe 1, maybe 2 barrels of oil or fuel, whatever, and they're zipping around. So they caught 7. So if you could fit 2 barrels into a canoe, you got 14 barrels of fuel. Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah.
Operation carried out by Ghana Navy ship, the GNS Afla-O, formed part of the Navy's mandate to secure the country's maritime domain, ensure the safety of legitimate businesses operating at sea. Okay, so you got 14 barrels of fuel. That's... Interception, which took place 1 nautical mile off the coast, led to the seizure of 7 canoes, as well as over 400 empty barrels. Say what?
And each barrel could take 250 liters. That's a lot of
intended
fuel.
Intended for illegal transportation of fuel into the country. So I checked out the photos. These are not what I would call canoes. They're about 40 feet long and 15 feet wide.
So I zoomed in and I estimated the size based on the man and the barrels and a typical barrel size.
Yeah, I measured.
So,
man size?
Yeah.
And I
each rib was 2 feet. I estimate it between 50 and 60 feet, each of these canoes.
Yeah, see, I got 40 when I sort of took the height of him with my ruler and measured it up. I got 40 feet.
Yeah, it's hard to judge 15. A man's height.
I guesstimated 5 feet.
He could have been a gnome, right?
He could have been 2 feet. Right. Yeah. He was a kid. Okay, so say somewhere between 40 and 60 feet and at least 15 feet wide, one of the canoes, and I'm using quotes, had 36 barrels in it, oil barrels.
Massive.
Who paddled these canoes? The Jolly Green Giant?
Well, I did a little research, and it typically, a voyageur's canoe, when they would move furs for the Hudson Bay Company, yada, 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 they were in the range of like 25, 35 feet. Mm-hmm. But voyageur canoes, sometimes the big ones, they called them the Montreal.
Yeah, Montreal canoe.
Montreal canoe, which was 42 feet long.
Yeah.
And you could have, like, what, 19 people in it and whatever with, and, you know, however many
tons of
gear.
Yeah, they'd sit two by twos.
Yeah, so some of them were pretty big. So these would be, these are larger than a Voyageur Montreal canoe.
You could fit, like, three of those Voyageur canoes in one of these canoes.
These are pretty big. These things that the Canada Navy took over. But you can see they're all hand-built, but they look well-made.
Oh, they do definitely look well-made.
With a flat stern, you could put an outboard on it.
Or a Volkswagen engine.
Or that, too. That, too.
Like I say, I'm just like, oh, really? Look at this. What are they smuggling now?
Yeah.
Because we've talked about them smuggling drugs and everything else. Yeah. And then I get this picture of the... That's not a canoe. I guess everybody, the word just gets thrown out there nowadays.
Yes.
Everything is a canoe that they can't think of a good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a boat. Anyway.
It is. They are pretty big.
But they hold 36
they are
to 40.
Of similar design to a canoe, but much larger.
It looks like when we were up in Moosonee, James Bay, they had the flatback canoes up there. Mm-hmm. They called them canoes.
Yep.
Picture that on massive, massive steroids.
Yes, yes.
That's what these things look like. These boats would be going by those ones on James Bay, and they'd be telling the guys, why don't you get yourself a real boat?
Exactly.
Get yourself a big boy boat like this.
What?
Nepal.
Oh, yes.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about...
Well, there's a lot
over there. There's so much going on over there with rafting.
A lot of stuff going on. A lot of stuff changing with the new licensing and training and all kinds of stuff like that.
So, in Nepal, mirroring Sherpa migration, which I didn't know the Sherpas were migrating, rafting guides are leaving Nepal in search of better economic opportunities. A couple of things here. Becoming a rafting guide takes 3 years of training but offers little stability at home. And that's 3 years of training before you're allowed to be a guide.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you need to get... one guy was, I think, 6 years before he was finally being known as a guide.
3 years training, 6 years as a guide.
Dams, environmental pressures, and weak promotion undermine Nepal's potential as a rafting destination. So there's a lot of things going against them.
They're building a lot of hydroelectric.
Mm-hmm.
There's more and more need for more and more power.
Well, and they're selling it to the countries outside, too.
Yes.
Around there, like their borders. Mm-hmm. For Puskar Kandel, a young man from a remote village near Trishuli River in central Nepal, local river beach was an open university where he learned the skills that would define his life. Spent all day at the beach or on the river, where senior rafting guides from his village taught him and encouraged him to practice kayaking, canyoning, and rafting. So I didn't even continue higher education after completing my intermediate degree. Instead, I joined the nearby Royal Beach Camp as an intern, where I learned all the skills required for leading river expeditions. After 3 years of training as an intern and another six leading rafting expeditions for foreign tourists across Nepal's rivers, Kandel had become a trusted name in the rafting community, but the profession he loved could not sustain him. Which is weird, considering how many rivers are there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He says, I didn't see a better future because our country is not yet fully promoted as a rafting destination. Today, Kandel, like many of his peers, works as a rafting guide in Japan.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the money is.
When we went in Japan, we went canoeing that day with the dolphin group.
Yep.
The one guy that was humping around the canoes was from Nepal.
Oh, okay.
right?
Okay.
So, yeah, they're definitely, yeah. I have firsthand knowledge of these guys.
Yes. Yeah.
Like you say, they're working in Japan, earning a stable income far beyond what was possible at home. Nepal is globally known for mountaineering, home to 8 of the world's 14 highest peaks, yet it is also crisscrossed by thousands of rivers flowing from the Himalayas and can be considered among the best destinations for rafting, kayaking, and canyoning. But industry representatives say that potential remains largely untapped. And see, I thought it was a booming business over there.
I thought so, too. And you hear about, well, there's 900 rafting guides in well, no, so that,
was, this,
that was
the India.
Yeah, it was India.
Area. Yeah.
So this is, India has a lot of the tourism, but Nepal doesn't?
I'm guessing. Industry representatives say that potential remains largely untapped, limited river permits, hydropower construction, environmental degradation, and inconsistent tourism flows have made guiding an unreliable livelihood. In Nepal, rafting has not been established as a sustainable adventure tourism industry. In Japan, the work is reliable and the salaries better.
I think it's more of a... People don't think of Nepal as a rafting destination. They think of it as a mountaineering destination.
Yeah. I would think, from what I saw, I would think of Nepal as a rafting destination more than I would think Japan is a rafting destination.
Correct. 100%.
Yeah. But rafting operators say repeated political instability, natural disasters, and economic shocks have disrupted tourism over the past decade, from 2015 earthquake and regional disruptions to the COVID-19 pandemic. Another problem, operators say, is a lack of promotion of water adventure sports. Like you say, everything's mountaineering.
Nobody's going to show up if you don't advertise it.
Exactly. Since rafting is not promoted, Nepal isn't a major rafting destination. Now, we talk about Paddle Nepal, but that's one company you hear about, right?
Yeah.
Guiding jobs are not reliable as the flow of raft-loving tourists isn't regular. Out of the around 6,000 rivers in Nepal, only about 16 are officially permitted for commercial rafting.
That's a tiny number.
Even among those, many routes have been shortened or damaged by dams, pollution, and climate change. Rivers permitted for rafting are also affected because of haphazard hydro dam construction. The government has increasingly prioritized hydropower projects as a source of national income, exporting electricity to neighboring countries, often at the expense of river-based tourism. It's hard to build up the tourism if you're...
Yeah.
Hey, come rafting!
Oh, never mind. We just built a new dam.
Yeah, we just built a new dam. Like, sorry about that. Training a professional rafting guide takes years of physical, technical, and psychological preparation. Nepal's Academy of Tourism and Hotel Management, the government body responsible for certification, has licensed about 1,300 rafting guides in recent years. Industry estimates suggest more than 60% now work abroad, either seasonally or permanently. So 60% of 1,300 guides left Nepal to work elsewhere.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Everyone is desperate to leave, says Bishnu Gurung, a rafting instructor who now works in Japan. It has created a huge gap in trained manpower at home. The migration of rafting guides follows the trend of thousands of Sherpas leaving the country, seeking a better future for themselves and their children. Rafting guides migrate to countries including Japan, Norway, Iceland, Switzerland, Australia, New Zealand, and India. More recently, demand has emerged from the Gulf, with Saudi Arabia recruiting licensed Nepali rafting guides. One can easily earn 230,000 Nepali rupees, or $1,600 a month abroad. In Nepal, a guide earns $3,000, or $20 a day.
That's, yeah. So it makes sense that they're going to leave.
It's like $400 a month versus $1,600 a month. In theory, guides could return to Nepal during the spring rafting season when rivers abroad are closed. In practice, many instead take other jobs during the off season abroad, since there's no guarantee of getting a job at home.
Huh.
Some guides have actually settled permanently overseas. Kandel, who married a Japanese citizen, is now planning to open his own rafting business in Japan. Good, because there's not enough of those.
Yeah.
I want to improve my economic status first, so I'm thinking of running my own rafting business in Japan at least for a few years. I have no plan to return to Nepal immediately, where rafting hasn't been established as adventure tourism. So, yeah, and you start thinking of it, and the majority of rafting stuff we hear about isn't from Nepal, it's just from India.
Yeah.
And you start, because they're right there.
Exactly.
You sort of lump them together, unfortunately, right?
Hmm. Yeah, I had a misunderstanding exactly what they were talking about. That's why I first came up with the 900 guides in India and stuff like that. And then I was like, wait a sec, this is Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hadn't even... And I do remember we had been in brief contact with a Nepalese whitewater kayaking group, but they said, hey, come visit.
Yeah, that was Paddle Nepal. Mm-hmm. They said, if you're ever over this way, come and see us.
So I had kind of forgot that they had this industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are kind of more known for mountaineering than than they are for...
Yep. There's a lot of stuff that leaves from Kathmandu, though, right?
Yeah.
Migration has made it increasingly difficult for operators to find trained guides inside Nepal. Says, we've reached a point where we need to produce guides ourselves, says Ram Silwal, who runs Royal Beach Camp. But there also needs to be a national effort to protect rivers and promote rafting as a viable profession.
Mm-hmm.
Industry figures warn that without meaningful policy support, from protecting rivers to promoting rafting and retaining training guides, Nepal risks losing a generation of skilled workers who could have transformed the country's vast river network into a cornerstone of its adventure tourism sector.
Exactly.
So now because I'm not into mountaineering and stuff, I didn't realize the Sherpas were migrating out.
I didn't know either, but they're, so it's not an easy life, and maybe there's limited, there's tons of opportunity, because there's so many people that do try to, there's so many mountains in the region that people climb, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's the big ones, like the typical ones, like in Nepal is like Everest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I guess, go where the money is, right? And if there's not enough business in Nepal to do rafting, then...
And you think, when you see the lineups on Everest now, and we're actually going to talk about Everest in a second here. Is there like one Sherpa looking at, is it one to one nowadays, or is it one for every five?
I think you've got multiple Sherpas on a specific group. From what I've seen typically is the people who are going to do the climb generally don't carry any of their own gear.
Mm-hmm.
You just hire a bunch of Sherpas. You're expected to hire Sherpas, right? That's the agreement. You're going to employ the locals and we'll help you get up the mountain type thing.
But now it makes you start to wonder how much money the Sherpas are actually getting.
Hmm,
I'm curious. They're starting to leave the country to find jobs elsewhere.
Yeah. Something's changed, eh?
Right? Anyway. So, hopefully they can turn things around and actually make Nepal a... promote their rafting and keep their people at home with mm-hmm. good pay, make it a viable resource for them. So I have to follow that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I only added this topic because I know we've talked about it a couple of times. And I know you're a big mountain climbing follower guy.
Yeah.
After a refundable policy didn't yield results, the new plan will require the creation of a trash checkpoint and pay rangers to enforce a cleanup rule on Mount Everest. Humans have become pretty reliable for leaving trash all over the place, as we know. One of the places that has become infamous for the sheer amount of garbage is Mount Everest. Now, we're not even talking about the bodies they leave up there.
True.
Since the 1980s, Nepalese authorities have been attempting to deal with it, but they've recently announced that they will be changing tack. A few years ago, Nepal made it a requirement for Everest Summit hopefuls to pack their trash, 18 pounds of it to be exact. It's estimated that there are around 50 tons of trash littered all over the world's highest peak.
That's incredible.
So climbers were required to take garbage back down the mountain. Theirs or not, it didn't matter. Or give up a $4,000 deposit.
Mm-hmm.
So pay me $4,000 if you bring 18 pounds of trash out.
I'll Which isn't a lot.
Well, especially since, well, like you say, if they're getting the Sherpas to carry their stuff.
Yeah, the Sherpas can carry it.
18 pounds, considering the amount of stuff you brought up to get you up there, yep. food yep. and everything else, you got to think you've lost 18 pounds on the way up. So bringing 18 pounds down
yeah.
isn't going to be that big of a deal. That policy has not cleaned up the mountain as much as officials hoped. So now all Everest climbers will be required to pay a non-refundable cleanup fee, and it's likely to cost about $4,000.
Hmm?
Under the mountain's prior policy, authorities were hopeful that the camp on South Col in particular would look a little more pristine and a little less like a trash dump. But $4,000 is apparently an accessible price tag for many mountaineers who choose to down climb unencumbered by extra trash. Also, many climbers would simply take 18 pounds of garbage from a lower camp where the issue isn't quite so glaring.
There you go.
Which is, yeah, that's kind of... from higher camps, people tend to bring back oxygen bottles only. Other things like tents, cans, boxes, packed foods, drinks are mostly left behind there. And that's why we can see so much waste piling up. There's one huge fault in the 18-pound rule. On average, an Everest climber will produce about 26 pounds of waste on the mountain over the 6 or so weeks it takes to get from the bottom to the top. And back again, that's 8 pounds more than the requirement, not to mention the pile of detritus that's already up there. So it makes sense that the problem hasn't gone away. I'm thinking they were thinking, well, if you're going to bring 18, you might as well just bring all your garbage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you got to bring 18 pounds of your 26 pounds of garbage.
Well, they abandon tents and cook stoves. They just abandon everything. It's like, oh, my climb's over. I spent like $80,000 to $120,000 to get here. I don't care that I leave my stuff behind. And that's normally the mentality. Like if you
I
see.
I don't get that because I want my. This tent yep. that I'm camping in?
Yeah.
I had that on Everest.
Yes, exactly. But some of these people are very. Usually very highly paid business people yeah. who don't care about stuff like that. Is it like you do? You see photos of whatever base camp, higher camps, and whatever. They all these tents are just torn in the wind and they've just been sitting there for years and. And so much garbage and trash is built up around them.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to like to make people carry that weight down. It's up at those altitudes to carry the extra weight down. It's tough, which is why they often leave human bodies up there. It's dangerous to recover them.
See, I'm thinking they got to load up like some sort of big sled and just point it down the mountain.
Yes. Yeah.
Apart from the checkpoint above Khumbu Fall, Icefall, there is no monitoring of what climbers are doing. Moving forward, things are going to change in hopes that a different plan will actually do something to mitigate the mounting issue. Climbers will be required to pay a non-refundable cleanup fee that will be used to create a checkpoint at Camp 2. Funds will also pay rangers to monitor the higher parts of the mountain. Hopefully, ensure the climbers are bringing down what they've brought up.
Hmm.
See, I'd do more than $4,000.
Yeah, charge them more. You know yeah. what? These people
make
are willing.
Even 10.
These people make, they're usually sponsored, and sponsors usually pay a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it? An average of $50,000 per person to, because you're paying the government and yada, 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 all these fees and park fees and access fees and plus all the money it costs to train and all the expense of the gear. They're already spent a lot of money.
Yeah.
Charge them 10, so 15 grand.
Yeah, charge them an extra 10, 15 for it. And I mean, we've seen the pictures now of the lineup just to get your picture taken on the peak now, right?
Yeah.
Everest doesn't mean anything anymore as far as I'm concerned.
Anybody can make it up there now.
Yeah. BBC reported that tourism ministry officials say it will most probably be $4,000 per climber, same amount as deposit money, and will come into effect once passed by the parliament. This is good news to the locals and anyone who cares about the state of the world's most famous peak. We've been questioning the effectiveness of the deposit scheme all this time because we are not aware of anyone who was penalized for not bringing their trash down. Mingma Sherpa, chairperson of the Pasang Lamu Rural Municipality. There was no designated fund, but now this non-refundable fee will lead to creation of a fund that can enable us to do all these cleanup and monitoring works. So yeah, if you got 100 people, that's 100 times 4,000. 400,000 bucks.
Yeah.
Start hopefully bringing some of this stuff out.
Yeah, start
paying. I don't know the logistics and stuff, but I guess, well, no, because I think helicopters and that can only get so high up there, right?
True. And so, and plus it's dangerous. So they're not going to risk those elevations to fly up just to haul down trash.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking like get big containers. Well, you know how they have the mollocks at the campsite? So it's a giant bag that hangs down in these holes in the ground, but at above the surface it's just like a regular trash can thing.
Yeah.
And then you put in that, and then they take that trash can lid off and they have a crane on a truck that lifts this big, basically a sock filled with garbage.
Yes, exactly.
So if you had one of those filled with trash and you brought a helicopter and hooked it up and then down the mountain, from the lower camps, right? So they don't have to get it all the way down, but if they could get it
part
of the way down,
helicopter accessible,
then they can get a helicopter accessible area, then that could be a good
help. Are those big inflatable balls that people can ride in?
Oh, those zoobies or something. Zoobies or something. Yeah.
Imagine, just fill that with trash and roll it down the mountain.
See, that's what I'm saying. Gravity is not being used as well as gravity could be used.
So you just pick a day. It's like, okay, on Sundays, nobody's allowed to be climbing up the mountain because that's the
trash
day. That's trash day. You're going to see these big
if you look up and there's a giant ball coming, run.
Hide behind a rock.
It's been nice knowing you. I swear, gravity. But if you put it all in there and then it hits a bump on a windy day,
boom,
and it goes way up, and then all of a sudden the winds take it to a different mountain, well, then it's not your problem anymore.
It's somebody else.
Somebody else's
mountain's problem.
Yeah. Where'd that ball go? Filled with trash.
We
300 kilometers that way. I just saw it bouncing peak to peak to peak.
We don't know what happened to it.
What happened? Scientists still don't know how this ball got here. All this trash.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's a continuing thing. Yeah, $4,000. Make it more. Yeah, make it
exactly.
More.
And maybe people will be more diligent in how much garbage.
There's got to be a number that starts to hurt people. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, if you're going to pay $120,000 to get up,
yeah,
then maybe we make it $140,000.
Yes.
Right? That extra $20,000 or whatever. It's got to be a number that's going to make you care, that you want that money back. Anywho. Last thing here, just want to reiterate the outdoor show time of year. This weekend, Hamilton Adventure Expo, January 24th, 25th, Ancaster Fairgrounds here by Hamilton Way. 2 days as opposed to the single day last year. Lots of speakers both days, lots of vendors to check out. HamiltonAdventureExpo.com for more information, like tickets and stuff. There's the Adventure Film Festival on the Friday night in Hamilton. And you're going there for 1 day, 2 days?
Probably one.
You're just going for 1 day? I'm going 2 days, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I talked to my wife, and so she's interested in going now, too. So we're going to probably drive up on the Saturday and go Saturday only when there's more speakers. And it'll be also more busy, but we'll see how it goes.
Toronto Outdoor Adventure Show, February 20th to 22nd, International Center in Mississauga, here out by Pearson International Airport. everything for outdoor fun and travel, lots of speakers on different stages, a water demo pool for paddling demos and such. Outdooradventureshow.ca for more details. And if you go to the outdooradventureshow.ca, you can also see that there's different dates for Vancouver, Calgary, Montreal.
Yeah, we realize not everybody is in our local area.
Yeah.
There's people listening to us from all over the place, so there are other locations for this exact same show.
We just won't be there.
No.
We could probably go to the Montreal one.
Yes. Yes, we could.
We could go to the Calgary and Vancouver one if we knew anybody that would give us free plane tickets.
Accommodate us.
Yeah. Free plane tickets and a hotel room.
Yeah.
Quiet Adventure Symposium, one of our favorite shows to attend, but not this year, unfortunately. Saturday, February 28th, 31st Annual Symposium held at the Michigan State University Farm Bureau Pavilion in Lansing, Michigan. 9 a.m. till 5:30 p.m. It's just a one-day thing. QuietAdventures.org, and don't forget to check out the rabbit show when you're there. Buy a rabbit. Take a rabbit home. And, of course, the biggie of biggies, Canoocopia, March 13th to 15th in Madison, Wisconsin at the Alliant Energy Center. Tons of speakers and vendors. Everything you need to see or want to know under one roof. Check out the Boundary Waters people that are there and see what you can do to help support them with all the, because I think this whole mining thing is coming, rearing its ugly head again, and they need all the support they can get.
Absolutely, so. 100%.
Check them all out, and rutabaga.com/canoocopia for more information. Other than that, that's all I got this week.
Hmm. I did dig into the fees for Everest.
Yep.
So,
$20!
Something like that. So there's a popular season, the spring season, which May is typically when most people want to go because that's your best guarantee of good weather. So that ranges from 11,000 to 15,000. Then there's all new fee structures like, so spring, March, May is 15,000 up from 11,000. And the autumn is cheaper. So anyways, by the time you add up all the fees and whatever, depending on how high up the mountain, because if you just go to base camp, it's a lot cheaper.
Right.
Because some people do.
There's a lot of people that do base camp trips.
Yeah, just base camp. It's no, you're not altitude climbing and whatever. You're still at altitude, but not as
high. So how much to get right to the tippity-tippity top?
In the spring, it can cost you up to $100,000.
Yeah. 104 pretty soon.
Exactly. Yeah. Because there's a lot of stuff. There's the basic fee is a royalty. Then there's mandatory costs. You have to hire a local liaison officer. Mm-hmm. And then depending on how many Sherpas you hire, then there's that cost is adds
food,
up to.
Food, oxygen, shelter. Exactly.
So it's expensive.
Medical.
So if somebody's willing to spend $100,000, they can spend a little bit more for trash cleanup.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's my whole thing is, if you're throwing out $100,000,
mm-hmm.
charge them a few extra bucks if they're not bringing their...
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? I would go as far as saying $20,000. You get 15 of it back if you bring down
a certain amount of garbage,
certain amount of cash. Yeah. Okay, you keep 5 of it towards this.
Yeah, new we're still going to keep some because we want to pay for the stuff you didn't bring down.
But you get 15 back if you bring down like 20 plus pounds of crap,
and all this extra money could be a source of income for these Sherpas who are leaving Nepal because they need to find money elsewhere.
Right.
So, hey, you know what? There's this extra fee. We can hire a whole bunch of Sherpas to hike the mountain and clean the mountain.
Yeah.
Go to base camp. Go to camp 2, camp 3, camp 4, whatever. Right?
They ought to build a permanent tube structure.
To slide garbage down.
Just like you see on the side of a building when they're construction. There's that tube that they throw stuff down in the garbage can.
I can picture it now.
Just one of those. You're hiking up the mountain, all you hear is and all of a sudden, you hear it go through this giant tube right next to you.
And you know somebody's going to go, I could ride down in that.
Right? That's like first day. First day somebody's dying because they wanted to jump into the tube and go for a ride to the bottom of the mountain. You'd hit the bottom of that. Could you imagine? Right from the tippy top, the top camp.
Like a gunshot. You'd be
all
flying
the way
at the
to
end.
The bottom. How fast would you be going when you hit that bottom? bottom.
Yeah, people do a lot of stuff for adventure.
You'd have to put like a ramp at the end. Like the two would have to swoop up.
Elevate it to slow your speed.
No.
Launch?
Shoot you. When you're hitting that at 300 kilometers an hour.
Exactly.
Boom. You're going right over Kathmandu.
Can you imagine?
You're just, woohoo. Oh, it's 12 o'clock and boom. You're looking up and there's these bodies flying through the air right above town.
Yeah.
And a giant net on the other side of town to catch you. Like, they could turn that into what? So, would you like to hike down or would you like the all expense paid? That'll be $10,000. Please sign here. Yeah. This insurance pay. We do not hold you responsible for what might happen to our dumb asses. Taking this tube. Who do I contact over there? This is definitely a moneymaker, I'm telling you.
People will pay for that.
People would pay for that. Hi, this is Mount Everest. Welcome to Jackass. People would do it, I am telling you. People would do it.
People who do the fastest. I reach 200 kilometers an hour.
200 kilometers an hour, zipping this tube, and all of a sudden...
launched
in. Oh, man.
That'd be great.
Right?
People would pay to watch that.
I would pay to watch that.
It's like be like a Running Man, one of those Running Man gag, those all those game shows with Running Man. Where
there's that Japanese
fighting
game
for money
show,
and the dogs and the alligator battles and whatever they had.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And who's the guy that gets to go in there and wax that up? Hopefully he doesn't fall.
They just have to grease up the guys that are sliding down.
No, just pour down a bucket of olive oil to coat the inside of it.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I can. Look up Kathmandu tourist ideas.
Yes,
give me the number. All right. You got anything else, man?
I don't.
Good. I got a call to make. If you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream all our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page on paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.